the UCR Podcast.
Happy Saturday, everybody. It is Matt Wardlaw. I took a break from spring cleaning, or should we call it spring annihilation? I got to bring you our latest podcast. So if you are also in the midst of cleaning, I've got something to add to your soundtrack as you work. Good news. Melissa Etheridge has just released Rise, her first studio album in 5 years, which she worked on with Shooter Jennings. Folks, let me tell you, Melissa and Shooter had some good mojo working and cooked up some really great things in the studio. The result is one of the strongest records we've heard from Melissa to date, featuring a number of highlights, including Don't You Want a Woman, which she debuted on her tour last year with the Indigo Girls, plus songs like Being Alive, Matches, and The Other Side of Blue, which features Chris Stapleton. Melissa made this record with her touring band, and these songs are ready for the road, which is a good thing because they just launched a big tour last night that's going to run all of the way through September 25th, including a run of shows this summer with Winona Judd that will feature an appearance at the legendary Red Rocks Amphitheater. It was a real joy to speak with Melissa for today's conversation. We get into a lot of different topics. As a longtime Springsteen fan, I loved hearing her take us behind the scenes a bit of the moment when she and Bruce got to sing Thunder Road together on her episode of MTV Unplugged. Fellow fans, I think you will enjoy this conversation. If you're not as familiar, take a listen to Melissa's new album, Rise, because I think it's a pretty good place to jump in that represents quite well a lot of what she's all about. And you can grab your own copy of Rise right now at store.ultimateclassicrock.com, where you can use the discount code Wardlaw15 to get 15% off of your order. And please also visit Melissa's official website for all of her tour dates, as well as other information you're going to want to be looped in on. MelissaEtheridge.com is the place to be. We hope you enjoy this conversation with Melissa Etheridge. Well, one of the things I love about your career, Melissa, is that you are still doing things for the first time. I had the pleasure of seeing you play Radio City last year with Indigo Girls, and I was just floored to hear you say that night that it was your first headlining show there. That's obviously such a legendary venue for both musicians and music fans. I know that must have meant the world to you to mark that off the bucket list.
Oh, it really was. And I actually realized a couple of years ago that my agent, who I've been with for over 10 years, he's an amazing agent that books me places, that he was listening to me when I would say, you know, I've never played here. You know, I've never played Radio City Music Hall. And he like puts his mind, I'm going to get you there. And I have played some of the last couple of years, played some really, really amazing places. And it's, you love that because they're historic. They're great places that you want to, you know, have sung a note in.
I'm here in Cleveland, and seeing your nomination to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that's meaningful partly because I got to see you play just that huge star-studded bill at the Rock Hall's grand opening concert. Back in 95 at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, you come out and just do a super cool set of songs. So obviously, I want to hear what the nomination means to you, but what are your memories of that grand opening concert? Like, I'm wondering if you got the chance to meet some of your heroes, because I thought about that as I was getting ready to talk to you, and it was such a day, like James Brown, Johnny Cash, the Kinks, like folks who really hadn't been together, like Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. And in the case of the Kinks, like there were bands and artists that we never saw again after that. So it was just a really special day.
Overwhelmed with how many of my heroes were there. It was overwhelming is a very, very good word. There were moments that are just seared into my head. I remember, my favorite memory is when James Brown was on stage and they had a bleacher side stage that you could come out and watch things on. That thing was packed with John Fogerty, Bruce Springsteen, John Mellencamp, myself, on and on and on. And we just, the bleacher was amazing. And then we're all watching James Brown. And I still get goosebumps when I think about it. Now the hardest part was I actually I have a Chuck Berry story now, like many others, where walked out so where Bruce Springsteen comes to me and says, "Hey, I'm going to do rock and roll music with Chuck Berry. You want to do it with me?" I was like, "Duh, yeah." So right before we go on, Chuck Berry tells us it's like in G, and we walk on stage, and the band that's playing was Duck Dunn, and it was the Stax band or whatever, which is great.
Sure.
Band, and they've been playing all day, and they're wasted. Okay, they're out of their minds, and we start the song, and it sounds so bad, and I'm looking at Bruce, and I'm looking around, and I'm like, we are not playing in the same, and it's a simple rock and roll song. It's rock and roll music, but Chuck Berry has done what he does, and he told the band one key, and he told us one key, and I tried to get over to band. I'm like, oh my God, what key are you in? And I'm trying to look at the fretboard, and he just keeps looking at me going, you're really pretty. I'm like, this is a nightmare. This is horrible. So my great Chuck Berry, Bruce Springsteen moment, I it's not even on the internet. It was so bad.
Well, here's the other music fan thing. And since you mentioned Bruce, that was the other thing I wanted to ask about, because it was such an iconic moment in the 90s when Bruce comes out to do Thunder Road with you on MTV Unplugged. And you tell the story of what that meant to you going into the performance of the song. But can you take us a little bit behind the scenes that day as far as getting ready for that with Bruce?
I just recently was working with a couple of young women who were like babies when I did that. And I said, oh, you got to see this. And I pulled up the YouTube of me introducing Bruce and then singing with him. And as I listened to myself talk to the audience, I got nervous all over again. My heart started, and I was like, oh my God, I'm feeling it again. This feeling of you're in a dream come true moment. Remember this for the rest of your life. Take it in, breathe. This is, you know, it's worlds coming together. And it was so special. The whole experience with him, from rehearsing the song up in the dressing room, this old at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, just sitting there with him, and we're practicing Thunder Road, and you know, we're saying, okay, you do this, you do that. And we're singing it, and he looks at me and he goes, you know, this song doesn't have any chorus. Like, it's the first time he ever thought that Thunder Road didn't have any chorus. I was like, yeah, Thunder Road doesn't have a chorus. And I said, no, but it's one of the greatest songs ever written, so I think you did okay. And then we walked on stage for the sound check, and he looked around and goes, where's your band? I said, dude, this is Unplugged. It's just me and my guitar. And he goes, you don't have a band. And this is before this was actually right before he did Tom Joad. He actually watched, and he did it with me, just him and I, and he had never broken it down so much. And after that, he went out with Tom Joad, and I was like, yay, you go be a solo guy.
I think that's what I've always appreciated about you, and what fans also appreciate about you, is that you have stayed a music fan through and through. Like, you talk leading up to that performance about being at home, you know, back in the 70s with your Koss headphones and the 8-track player. And it's like, then if I think about you being out on tour now, it's like you'll throw something in where it's like you cover Chapel Roan or you cover Father Figure. Yeah. And then it's like on this new album with Matches, like it is just so perfect the way you define, like, how you realized that you want to do this for a living. And the way you term it of saying, I want to play with the Matches. Like, I never thought about that, about thinking of music like that, but that's a really great way to think about it.
When that came to me, when I was sort of swimming in the memory of when Johnny Cash came to my hometown of Leavenworth, Kansas, which we didn't even have a venue for people to play. So anybody coming to Leavenworth, Kansas was huge news, but he was playing at the prison. And so I was 8 years old, and it made such an impression because it was in the local paper. I knew I could see the prison from my backyard. It was like 3 blocks away. And I had just done the last project I did was with the Topeka Correctional Facility for Women, which is a women's prison in Kansas. And people had been asking me, and I was telling them this Johnny Cash story, and I was just, you know, in it. And I remember just thinking, oh, that he could come to my town means that somehow there's a possibility that I could go out in the world. Somehow it made sense in my 8-year-old brain. And music and singing music for people was the thing that was lighting me up, and it was just what I wanted to do. And I was thinking of, you know, and no one's going to look at in 1969 is going to look at a little girl and go, "Oh, you want to be a rock star? Okay." You know, no, it did that. That wasn't something. And so it was that sort of forbidden thing that I wanted to do. And so matches is that story of, "Oh, mama, let me play with the matches. Let me do it." By the time I was 13, I was playing in bars, in like cover bands with these older guys. And my mother I would hate it. I don't want my 13-year-old going to a bar. So I understand it now. But then I'm like, no, please let me do this. Let me play with the matches. And so as that came to me and I'm writing it in the song, actually Matches is one of my favorite songs on the album.
I love just that song. Before you even get to the words in the song, I love just the tone and the sound of that song. Like, how did that come together? Because you just so naturally, and I think you've done this a good amount, but you just so naturally and gently bring the listener into the song with the sound and the tone of the way that song unfolds.
Matches was I call it my scratch pad song. When I go in to write, there's like I have a big notebook, and on like the first page, second page, I've just got lyrics, just blah, blah, you know, probably "Mama, Let Me Play With The Matches" was written on it because that's, you know, the feeling that I wanted. And it's the scratch pad song is just, I have no expectation for this song. I'm just throwing things out and throwing lines together. And the intro to the song is so different. And then how I turned the song from minor to major was not even, if I had been constructing like, okay, this is song number 3 and I'm going to do this, I would have constructed it differently. But because I was more freeform, it really flew. And then when I realized, oh, I need to get into the verse this way, I was just like, oh, well, I'll just do this. Kind of, you know, not carelessly, but just easily. And that's why the song has this sort of easy feel to it. And I wasn't even going to put it on the album until I played it for my wife. And she was like, oh, no, you have to put that on the album. I'm like, okay.
I like that your wife, kind of like my wife, is kind of the voice of reason, because I've heard you talk about her a few different times. Like, for instance, her saying, "Why aren't you playing this lead guitar?" Yeah. So it's always the wife that goes, "You got to do this." And it's, so sometimes I'll just pause silently and my wife will go, "No, you're doing this," or "I'm going to send the email. You're doing this."
Yeah, they know kind of, they can see past our own inner editor that, you know, he's criticizing us. They're like, "No, push that aside. No, do this." It's like, oh, and it's that love and that belief in you that is just so, I'm so grateful I've got her in my life. So grateful.
I think I thought of really how I would have wanted to describe Matches as far as how it makes me feel as a listener. And it's kind of the same thing as The Other Side of Blue. I think both of those songs are kind of like, they almost kind of take you into kind of like a musical kind of fever dream kind of place. And that's what you really love as a listener, is those songs that kind of take you to a place before you even get into why you're there. And so certainly that happens with Matches, and you go a whole other different place, obviously, with The Other Side of Blue and Chris and all that kind of stuff. But I think both of those songs are pretty magic, and it had to feel pretty good, you know, as those, I mean, I guess we can shift to The Other Side of Blue, but as The Other Side of Blue starts to unfold like that, it's got to feel pretty good when you have a song like that taking shape.
Oh, The Other Side of Blue is a whole nother creation. But I'll get back to that. But the point I want to make to you is that the intention for this album was I wanted it to sonically attract people. And I wanted it to be the album that you can drive, take that 45-minute drive you got to take, and you're starting with the first song, and then you turn it up a little, and you turn it up a little more because it just sounds so good in your car. That's what those songs are. And so those intros and everything are just, I wanted it to be, when I drove out to California from Kansas, I had, you know, tapes of the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac and even Tom Petty, and just this sort of, this rock and roll California rock. And so I, working with Shooter Jennings production, I said, this is the sound I want. I want it to sound like those good, rich, yummy just songs you can sit in the middle of and hear the guitar being played and hear everything. So The Other Side of Blue, now that was made, I had recorded the album and I hadn't worked with Chris. I had put out a request if he would like to work with me. And he said yes, which was, he was the only one I was interested in collaborating with. And he, and so I went down to Nashville. I'd never met him. I never talked to him at all, but he, we showed up at RCA, it was Nashville, RCA Studio B, I believe, which is this massive, Chet Atkins used to record the Cosmopolitan Records, and it was just the biggest studio I've ever been in my life. And he and I are just in there, just he and I in the corner writing. And I came in and we just started the small talk. I asked him, you have any kids? He always got five kids. Oh, he's really busy. We were just talking. And then he asked me if I have any kids. I said, oh, well, I had four, three of them are this and this, but I lost one about 5 years ago. And he's, oh, I'm so sorry. And he, you know, was like, and I said, no, it's, you know, he was my greatest teacher. And Chris stopped and looked at me and he said, wow, Melissa, you sing in song. I mean, you talk in song. And that's the first lyric, and we started writing it right there. And for the next hour, that song just rolled out. Oh, and I love it.
That's my
favorite thing on the album. God.
It's really something. The song that kind of made me think of it, made me think as a music fan of hearing Mary Chapin Carpenter sing with James Taylor on one of her records in the past decade. It just sometimes it feels so natural when you hear two people sing together, and it feels that way with you and Chris. Like, did it fall in pretty easily like that?
Oh yeah, I realized very quickly as he came up with the A minor living in the minute, and so he would sing that note, and I'd go, oh, and it sounds so good, and then I would just come and go with that little harmony note. After it, you know, a whole beat after it. And I just could never come in at the same time because I just wanted to hear him sing that one note. And it just rolled out after that. And we just, my wife was sitting way over on the other side and she just took notes of what we were doing. And it was just a very special moment.
It's probably still pretty magical for you, like just finding moments like that, finding a blend with somebody. Like that doesn't seem like it would ever get old.
No. No, that doesn't ever get old. No, music, that part of music never gets old. There are times when I listen to the song and I can't tell whether it's him or me singing.
Wow.
In those parts, I'm like, wait, which part is him? Which part is me? And I had told him at the end, because I didn't know if he was going to record it with me or not. I said, Chris, I really think that the world would be very happy to hear us sing together. You know, let's do that.
You mentioned Shooter, and one of the things that Shooter says in the press materials that's super cool is no one plays the 12-string acoustic like Melissa. And I don't play, but the 12-string has always been so, it's been pretty fascinating to me. It has such a sound. What drew you to the 12-string?
Well, again, I grew up in the 70s, and I grew up with everything from Boston with that great 12-string to the Eagles, with every 12-string you ever heard on that, to Roger McGuinn. And when I was about 12, I think I went to a church camp weekend or something, and some older boy had a 12-string. And I just went, whoa, what's that? And I sat down with it, and it was huge. It was like a big guild. It was, you know, and I could barely get around it. But I was like, what are you doing? I said, is it the same? And he's like, yeah, it's exactly the same. You just push down two at the same time. And I was like, this is pretty intense for my little hands, but it sounded so big and I wanted that big sound and I loved it. And I knew that, oh, this is what all those artists are using. And right at this time, Ovation was releasing their, this is actually a right there. That's a,
oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a 12-string Ovation that they actually did a reissue for me, made because my first guitar like that got stolen, but it was electric. You could just plug that thing in and it didn't feed back like all the regular acoustic things. And so I just started playing. And when I played solo, when I did all my gigs solo, in the bars and the lounges and stuff, it just, it filled up so much more space. And I started to develop kind of a rhythmic like I missed the drums. And so I would do all these things on it. So I just developed this style on the 12 string and I started playing it and I never stopped. And so my hands are like you could burn the tips of my fingers and I couldn't feel it. The calluses are so deep, but it is something that I do now that I realize that not many people do.
How much did that change your writing process?
Probably a lot. I mean, you hear like the first album is really the result of, I mean, you hear like Precious Pain. That's just 12 string. That's me playing Late September Dogs. All the ballads are that. And then you hear Bring Me Some Water, which is, and that's my 12 string. That's me slapping. And if you see me in concert, I'm still just beating my 12 string up because it's a lot of fun.
That's pretty fantastic. And just talk about Shooter just generally. He's so musical. Are there moments as you guys are making this record where you're kind of sitting around the two of you with instruments, like playing ideas or thoughts back and forth to each other?
It's funny. He didn't pull out any instruments. There was a little keyboard thing at the beginning of Matches where he kind of put this thing in there. But I think he didn't pull out any instruments, but I loved his ear. He would listen to us because it was me and my band. And he just really loved and respected all the other three guys that I was working with and how well we sound together because we've been playing years and years, you know, locking in. And he would only come in with suggestions every now and then. His allowance of the music to just unfold and become was what it is, and then kind of guide it. And anytime sometime I go, what do you think? You know, should you have an idea? Then he would give an idea. But boy, he was hands off, except when just like when he needed it.
Matches made me think about being a storyteller, and I think everybody I would imagine kind of has to work into that. And one thing I was thinking about as I was getting ready to talk to you was about how the One Way Out album, you put some songs that you hadn't felt comfortable about releasing then, you put those out. With some of them, it's before you came out. But just generally what that made me think of is how, as a songwriter, how vulnerable you are sharing songs with your bandmates, eventually sharing them with the fans once you get to that point where you have fans. So it's a lot before you even get to the moment where then you're perhaps comfortable sharing stories that come from a real place. And Melissa, as you know, like for some people that's easy because writing what they know is all they can do. It's very natural. It's more of a struggle for others. So for you, like what's kind of the moment you can remember where you started feeling comfortable doing that? Because that opens up a huge thing from a storytelling perspective.
Well, that actually happened when I was playing in the bars here in Los Angeles. I was playing actually down at Long Beach. I was playing in these women's bars, which was great because I could absolutely be myself 100%. And I was writing songs, and I still wrote very genderless songs. It was me, you, you know, them or something, but I would write songs, right? I mean, I was constantly writing songs, and I would take them to the club, and sometimes I'd do them, or I'd slip it in, or I'd say, "Oh, this is a," but mostly I was playing cover songs, and little by little I would start playing originals. And I remember the first time somebody came up to me and said, "You played a song the other night, and you said you wrote it, and it was like The Way I Do." And when that was the first song of mine that anyone ever requested. And I
that's went, cool. Oh.
It, just knowing that one of my songs left an impression on somebody. And Like The Way I Do was very personal. And it was very, it just happened. It was silly, ridiculous love stuff. But I had written it, and it was just from my gut, you know, and that's when it was very clear to me that when I write personally about what I'm going through, what I know, and write it in a way that can be listened to universally, then that's when you connect. That's when the audience can really connect with you because they can relate to it. They can feel it. I'm being real. And then we all have that experience together.
I mentioned Chapel Roan, and that's just something that like I said, it's been cool, you know, seeing some of the stuff that you kind of stick in, or at least stick in a snippet of in your live show, whatever it is. It seems like it's a mix of, look, we're all music fans. I know you love this song, if it's like Father Figure or whatever it is. But then it's also like, look, you know, I'm hearing this stuff from Chapel Roan. I dig it. You know, I want to put some of this into your universe. Like, it seems just overall like you enjoy finding your way into the music, whether it's stuff that you've written or stuff like that, that you're just a fan of.
Because it is just all about the audience and me in that moment. Sometimes I'll just pull stuff out that I'll be jamming with somebody, with my band, and it'll feel so good. And I'll think, oh, man, this sounds like an old Rolling Stone song. And I'll just start singing over it. And the band just always knows to just hang in there with me, and I'll get back to the song eventually, you know. Those moments I love. I always told my band, I love being completely live and inspired in the moment. So just always be on your feet. You just never know, and just follow me as best you can, you know, and they do. They never take their eyes off me, because especially in a really fun going show, they know that that's when I might take off on something.
Here's where I'm going to wrap. And that just is, you know, when you talked about what a good driving record this is, I have not gotten to take it out in the car, but it's like I instantly heard that in my headphones as I was thinking about it. But you have to be itching. You are about to head out on a long stretch of touring. And this past fall, again, going back to that Radio City show, it was so cool seeing you play Don't You Want a Woman as part of that show, and just how naturally that slots into the show. And I can just hear that so much of this record is made for the stage. So it's just, you got to be itching to play this stuff.
I realized that years ago. I was like, okay, I can, you know, be all as clever as I want to be in the studio, but I'm going to live with these songs for years, and I'm going to sing them. So when I was approaching this album, I said, I want every song to be able to just go right on the stage and it be the song that you hear on the record. And it was very, very intentional. That's why I went in with my band. That's why, I mean, we did do overdubs. We made it sound good. It's not going to sound exactly like it, but it's going to be the meat of the song. It's going to be, you're going to know it. You're going to be able to hear it live and then go find it and it be the song. I want people to go, oh, I like that. Maybe I'll get that album or whatever. That's the way I work now.
Well done. This is another good one. And, you know, we'll look forward to seeing you out on the road. So thank you for the time. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you. It was a real, real pleasure.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.